Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 4, Episode 21 of Cinematica. My name is Dan Slavin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio, we have the full team assembled once again.
Avengers assemble.
Indeed. Hello over there.
Hi.
And hello over there.
Yeah, hello.
Sorry, I'm a bit tired today.
Hi, campers.
Yes.
Well, yeah, we're going to try and nurse Kaylee through this afternoon's recording because she went to the movies late last night and was
not
up,
impressed.
Up past her bedtime. So,
how late did you go?
8:40.
Whoa.
That was the longest 2 hours of my life, but we'll get to that.
Okay, yeah, indeed.
Right. So is it actually the content that's made you world weary, or is it the time?
So many things.
In today's episode, we've just had a few hints dropped. Ashton Kutcher impersonates Steve Jobs in Jobs. Bruce Willis impersonates an action hero in Red 2. And also, just to balance things, Kiwi arthouse movie The Weight of Elephants slips quietly into theatres this weekend. And we'll be talking about that in a little while. But first, let's just check out what's in the mailbag. We got a lot of interest in all of our giveaways, although there are still a few lurking around, which we'll talk about at the end of the show, maybe, just to get the rest of our passes away. But what have people been tweeting us?
Well, aside from I would like much ado passes, which...
There's been a lot of those.
Yes, those were the first to go. I sent off the last pair today, so congratulations to everyone who got their hands on those. Talking about Kick-Ass 2 last week on the show, Adzabil tweeted us, Cinematica cast folks will be thrilled to know that Hoyts, for one, did not get the memo about Kick-Ass 2. Attached a photo of their listing in the paper... As Kick-Ass 2 balls to the wall.
Yeah, that's good on them. Yeah, good on them for that. Right. That's,
Adzabil also talking about a film, which I don't know which one, but said it was worth seeing. Sweetly Quirky would be my CinemaCast 2 would review.
No, would that be Frances Ha, I think?
Oh, yes, Frances Ha.
Yeah, you got to scroll back. Scroll back through
scroll
the timeline.
Scroll back. Way back. Lots of people asking for tickets. Oh, Algulously, I think is how you pronounce it. Cinematica cast is the only thing that comes up when searching for Gaylene Preston on iTunes.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh.
Yeah, and she's been on the show twice. Mm. So
it's time to get it back, isn't it?
Well, yeah,
just for
I think so.
A cup of tea or something. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely. Well, there's certainly always lots to talk about with her.
Yes. And Barnaby HM sends us his two words for Elysium, which are overcooked Damon. Wah, wah.
And he does get cooked.
Yeah, indeed.
Ew.
All right.
You'd expect the microwave door ding when it opens, but you don't get that, do you? Yeah.
Now, it's time. Last time I spoke to you, Simon, last week, it was all sort of doom and gloom, and you know, no one was coming to the movies.
It's
and,
an emotional
you know,
roller coaster. This
it
business,
is, the post festival lull, and it was, and here we are today on the southerlies hit Wellington. The rain is pouring down. It's perfect movie going weather, and it took me 20 minutes to find a car park outside the theatre here. Never has it taken me so long to find somewhere to actually just park up. So packed downstairs. So what's changed?
I don't know. People are just in the mood, maybe. I mean, we've done a sneak screening, well, a Seniors Wednesday preview of Blue Jasmine, which seemed to just really kick off. It was interesting, actually. So that's done very well today. So it opens properly tomorrow. Mm. And it's looking like a strong film. Everyone came out of it was just buzzing.
The word of mouth is really strong. What else were people going to see this weekend, Kaylee?
Sitting at number 5, down from 4, Now You See Me. At 4, down from 3, We Are the Millers. 3, down from 2, Mortal Instruments, City of Bones. At 2, down from 1, is Elysium. And opening in the number 1 spot is Red 2. And just off of the top 5, opening at number 6 is Jobs.
Oh, right. Okay. That's interesting. Can you look at a total? Can you compare a total for the weekend compared to the weekend before, just to see whether it was sort of flat? Yeah. Simon is going to read the runes for us.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, it's not a big difference, to be honest.
Okay.
It's a variance of about 8%. From the previous weekend to the current. This is also not a full week.
It's just the Thursday to Sunday.
Yeah, right. So it's you know,
the most important days of the cinema week.
Yeah, it's indicative anyway.
Yeah, they are the most important. And I mean, but it is still, you know, I think there's product. It feels like you've turned a corner a little bit, and the trade is starting to get stronger again.
And the official summer season in the US has finished with Labor Weekend, which just passed, and there's lots of pundits trying to sort of sum up what the summer was like, and you know, there was a lot of doom and gloom around about the performance of certain films, about the sameness of the big blockbusters, about how several films didn't perform to what was expected of them, things like The Lone Ranger. But actually, when you look at the stats for the US summer box office this year, it was actually up 10.5% on last year.
Mm.
And which is, you know, for everybody who's saying that, you know, the industry is it was going down the gurgler.
So what does that mean to Lucas and Spielberg, who said that if, you know, yeah, some of these films tip over, it'll be...
At some point, a $250 million movie is going to cark it.
Haven't we seen that before with John Carter and things?
Yeah, and what was the other one? Battleship? Yeah, who knows? One of the things about the studios is that they are really, really good about minimizing their losses, right? Interestingly, you know, a lot of that 10.5%, or some of that 10.5% is just increase in prices and the 3D premium. Mm. But actually, admissions were up 7.75% on summer of 2012. So people were going to the movies. And interesting stats out of the States in terms of what the big films were. Iron Man 3, which was the first big film of the summer, the only film to do $400 million domestically. And so if you look at the chart for the big blockbuster movies weekend after weekend, it started really high with Iron Man 3 and then just tails off.
Yep.
And I think that's partly why people are feeling so gloomy, is because actually by the end of the summer, you know, things weren't as great as they were. So a lot of that is skewed by how strong Iron Man 3 was. Interesting, looking at the worldwide for the top five summer films worldwide, Man of Steel at number five, $657 million. But better than that, Monsters University.
Yep.
On $715 million at number four. Number three, Fast and Furious 6, $787 million. Number two, can you guess?
Despicable Me.
Despicable Me 2, yep. As at $823 million. And Iron Man 3 was the biggest film of the summer internationally, worldwide, with $1.2 billion. And interestingly, World War Z, which everyone was talking about when it came out as being the potential box office crash and burn, you know, Brad Pitt's, you know, attempt at sort of box office superstardom failing, has now hit $400 million. US dollars internationally, as has Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
So, you know, actually a lot of those films that everyone was saying, oh, you know, these are going to be turkeys, have turned out to be less so because the international box office for those has been really strong. And China has been sort of leading the way with a lot of those, like $100 million in China, which is, you know, amazing for some of those films. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom, but as we were talking about off air, something like Red 2 came out this weekend. I had a choice of 38 different sessions that I could choose from on Sunday.
Yeah.
That I could go to. Now, it seems to me that that's just a
could
little
you do
wider.
More in a row? I mean, that would have been exciting, wouldn't it?
And I didn't even include the gold class sessions because they're basically the same as the other one. So, like, there was just the listings, it was just almost too much to choose from.
Mm.
And it's too wide, isn't it? for anything to have that many sessions on a single day in a city like Wellington, where, you know, what's your average going to be? What's the average attendance going to be in a 300 seat theatre?
It kind of also reflects, though, that you've got a number of locations around the country who've been playing the film festival, or you know, they haven't had all the product that they wanted over the film festival, all those sorts of things.
So they're opening everything at the same time.
This is the next film that, you know, is going to try and, you know, kickstart things again, so everyone's in for a penny, you know. And that's so it's not kind of surprising from that point of view. You know, it's the first strongish film to come through post. I mean, you got Now You See Me and things like that, but then post festival, it's kind of the first sort of mainstream film to kick in.
That is true, and I guess if you have been a festival venue, then you don't have anything that's currently playing that you can play through.
So maybe, you know, it's not just your traditional multiplexes playing it, but it's outside of that. Even though for us, you know, I remember when the first Red film came along, we actually picked it up second run and did quite well with it. It's a different film, this one. I mean, it's more upfront box office, and I think it's going to have a shorter shelf life. So
Talking of second run, something that that happens a lot more overseas than it does here in New Zealand, I noticed that This Is the End has just been re-released in the US this week, which is and they reckon that the weekend that it's just had will be enough to push it over 100 million domestically in the US. Star Trek Into Darkness has been re-released as well, and so there is. This is something that I think is I've never seen before, which is that, you know, going back for a second bite of the cherry at roughly the same time as you go to home video.
So they do it over the holiday period as well, do they? They bring it back for a second snap over the holidays.
I'm not sure what the timing is, because it's actually post summer holidays in the States. Yeah. I think it might actually be that there's a whole lot of marketing around home video. And so there's a whole lot of attention. So why not stick it back in cinemas so people who maybe missed it. Yeah. We'll have another crack at it, but it is—it's interesting. We just don't have the screen space to sustain that sort of thing here, do we? You know, there's so we get so many films are being released.
Well,
there's
risky, no room, too, isn't it? It's risky in that you could put it on and people—it's done and dusted. It's not
old hat.
Yeah. So it has its risks, I would have thought.
And something else that I found in New York when I was there is that there are cinemas dedicated to second run. So you know, $8 a ticket. Cinemas, and with
do they tend to be single screens?
No, they're multiplexes, but they're older. They'll be older multiplexes.
Yeah.
But the thing is, with DCP, there's no you're not getting an old print.
No, that's
you right. know. So actually, you know, if you've missed something, having it sort of step down to a cheaper venue actually extends the life of the film quite a lot.
It does. It does. Even though traditionally prints were, you know, like they narrowed the market, and so. You got it's probably more of a juggling act in terms of working out what's going to stick after it's had its big release. You know, I think it's a little bit harder.
It's all a gamble, isn't it? That's why it attracts you with characters like yourself.
Yeah, but you got to back the content, don't you? And that's the thing. I mean, if you're hot on the content, and you'll bring it back. But if it's so-so, you might have reservations. You know?
Yeah. When I was at university, I lived about like 5 blocks from a second run theater, and it was the greatest thing ever. It was so cheap, and they had the best peach juice ever.
But what about the films? You know, like
they would bring back.
Were they careful? Did they curate a program, or was it just whatever they could get?
I'm not sure because I didn't really talk to them. But right. it was the bigger action flicks, whatever would make them money, right, basically. Yeah. Would come in, and so my roommate and I would usually do double features on a Sunday together.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah. That sort of thing is.
Yeah. And they had a discounted double feature price. Like you could see one movie for $8 or two movies for $10 or something. Yeah.
It's interesting there because it's not really done here. That double feature discount.
I tried to do
films.
It. Yeah, I tried to easy, do it when I was at the Paramount, and it was one of the things I was most excited about. Was to be able to, like, great, I get Sunday night double features I can program. And I went to distributors and asked them about it, and they said, well, yeah, it's a great idea, but the other film in the double feature has to be from us too.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Oh, really? So it narrows your options, doesn't it, quite a lot? Yeah, but so, yeah, because we don't split the money.
Do it overseas. I mean, if they can do that in the US.
I know. Exactly. It was always my argument, but it was like, no, the paperwork was just going to be way too hard if they had to split the money. And, you know, one film was going to be at 25%, one film was going to be at 35%, and blah, blah, blah. It was mission in the end.
I did do it once. What did I do it with? It was like two...
Do you remember the palaver of trying to set it up?
Yeah, I do. But what were they? They were. It actually worked, didn't it?
It did, but I can't remember how
we did it. Can't remember the films.
Thanks. Good one.
There you go.
Was it a lead up to something like a third of it, the trilogy?
No, it was like else? Two political films. It was two sort of, you know.
I remember doing it, but I don't remember what film.
It just shows you how much resonance
it was like Inside Job and something else. It was like that. It was like Inside Job and that other film that came out with the guy in Star Trek who made it. Maybe it was that. I don't know.
Oh, Margin Call.
Yeah, maybe it was that. Or maybe those it was something two. Else. Yeah. I don't know. I can't.
Doesn't seem right.
Maybe that was just a dream I had.
Maybe that was something you wanted to do.
That's right.
All right. Time to talk about what's actually happening in the real world now.
Tell you the difference between glass and crystal, Adrian. Difference is a crystal sinks.
You'll be frightened, but you can't be a coward. You must be prepared for whatever happens.
It's a trailer that doesn't really give very much away about that particular film, The Weight of Elephants by Daniel Borgman, a New Zealand feature that is co-produced out of Denmark by Zentropa and the Danish Film Institute and played at the film festival. And Sai, you have notes. I'm so impressed.
Well, I thought I had a bit of time up my sleeve today. I don't know how I did, but I thought I'd check it out. Yeah, so this is recently played in the New Zealand Film Festival and, you know, directed by Daniel Borgman, who, New Zealand born, lived in Dunedin and has shot this in Invercargill. And like you say, it's a joint venture. The first co-venture, I don't think it's a formalised type of arrangement between the New Zealand Film Commission and the Danish Film Institute. And of course, I mean... Daniel Borgman, doing a little look at him, he's got a bit of pedigree. I mean, he's got a short film into Cannes, Lars and Peter, and he looks like he is, you know, a star on the rise, shall we say.
Well, the Danish certainly think so, which is, I talked to him at the Big Screen Symposium, and he said that the Danish Film Institute, who funded it, have said that, you know, they consider this to be, you know, a stepping stone for him.
Yeah, and It is a very well constructed film. It is not an easy watch, I don't think. It's beautiful. It's great to look at visually. It's quite stunning. But it is a hard film, and it's filmed from the point of view of this young boy who's been left with his grandmother, who's also looking after her son, who is suffering from, you know, severe depression. And so there's this young, I think he's like 9 or something like that, you know, and so he's, this boy is finding it very hard to connect and actually have people in his life. I mean, the adults in the film seem to be very fleeting. They sort of make connections with him and then they disappear.
And they're wrapped up in their own lives, aren't they?
Their own lives, their own problems. Yep. And so it's quite, you know, it's quite, it's not painful, but it's just, I'm sure within everyone there's that little memory of when they're that age trying to find their way in the world and how hard it is, you know, how hard it is to be social with people and so on. And so when you've got this added burden of this boy being sort of feeling like he's not wanted, he's been left with this grandmother, and then the only kind of friend that he has is this manic depressive who's kind of in and out. Like, he's sometimes in the film he's quite friendly and charming, but then other times he's just, you know, really, really low and hard on the boy, but not intentionally.
Played by the wonderful New Zealand actor Matt Sunderland,
who's great.
Just a brilliant actor.
He is. He's really good. I mean, the cast in this is very good. The young children in the film are great. The woman who plays the grandmother is very familiar. Catherine Wilkin, who, you know, when you see, you go, oh yeah, okay, I've seen this woman on a lot of stuff, you know, so I think it has, you know, everyone's doing a very good fist of the acting in the film. But it is. I've heard some comparisons, you know, some reviews have sort of said, you know, it's almost in the vein of In My Father's Den and those sorts of films, and I don't see that myself. I think it's too, it doesn't have the intrigue and the sort of, you know, somebody who's been around a bit longer, I think, and made, you know, just had a better feel for what they were making. I mean, it's based on a novel, or inspired by a novel,
Australian novel
of a boy by Sonia Hartnett, and relatively, I mean, I never heard of it before, but. It's interesting that this is a film that doesn't make me want to rush out and buy the book and read it, you know, because it is, It is tragic in a way, and kind of bleak.
Well, the background, there's a background to the story in that some children have been abducted in the town, and there's a sort of shadow looming over everyone's lives. While you watch shots on television of searchers sort of combing through undergrowth and what have you, and it's really interesting the effect that it has on a child, with nobody trying to explain, nobody stops to explain to this kid what's going on, you know, or give them some kind of counselling through the experience. And as a child, news stories like that, if nobody holds your hand through them, they can be really traumatic.
Yeah, that's right. And that, of course, he's certain these people move in next door and they've got these young children, and he, as are we. We're taken into the view that these may be the children that have gone missing, and he's very curious, and he meets these kids, and I mean, even the children that he meets, or the kids at school that he meets, you know, especially this group of boys that he tries to be friends with, you know, it sort of is fleeting again. It lasts for a while, but he's always this outsider. But with the children next door, he's not, and they're relative, you know, they're welcoming in a way, they're actually suffering the same sort of feelings of isolation that he is, and that's their bond, and they sort of do grow from there. But you know, it's interesting. When I was looking at this, I came across that, you know, there was one comment that said it was sort of filmed in the spirit of Dog Me, and I thought, what's this Dog Me? I have never, you know, sort of, it was interesting in the sort of the rules of Dog Me and which was sort of established by Lars von Trier a few years ago, wasn't it? And is now sort of inactive, has sort of been moved away from.
It had the right effect on the movie making, and certainly in Scandinavia. But as I read an interview with Borgman, where he said that the great thing about the rules of Dogma are that, you know, you try and get around them.
Right.
Yeah. Not very many people, apart from maybe Lars von Trier himself, actually embraced them. You know, they were usually something to try and cope with.
Well, I came across the Dogma Vow of Chastity, and the top 10 things that are in that. And then, filming must be done on location. Props and sets must not be brought in. Music must not be used unless it occurs within the scene being filmed. The camera must be handheld. Filming must take place where the action takes place. The film must be in color. No special lighting. Optical work and filters are forbidden. No superficial action. No murders or weapons. No temporal or geographical alienation. No genre movies. The aspect ratio must be 4:3. Not widescreen. The director must not be credited. And I thought, you know, this is actually, I mean, and when you sort of read this and you think about the film, you know, gee, you know, you can see those influences. You can certainly see a kind of Lars von Trier type look to this film.
It's a European film, I think. That's it, that you definitely get a sense. And a sense of that, and partly because this is not an unusual story for New Zealand filmmakers to approach, you know, this idea of kids with absent parents trying to find their own way, films being told from the kids' point of view. This is like a counterpoint to Boy in lots of ways, which is the biggest New Zealand box office film ever.
Yeah.
But this is a very European, very art house, very considered approach
to that
topic.
And that's what's funny about it for me, is that it doesn't have that, even though it's, you know, it's very clearly the Deep South, and it does have a look to it, like in My Father's Den, in a way that sort of look to it, I think. But it has no quirkiness or kind of humour that is usually in a New Zealand film. There's no warmth to it. There's no funny moments. Just, you know, it's really very, very serious.
It's quite clinical. It's also shot almost entirely in close-up, which is great because that's sort of how kids see the world. You know, you're down low to the ground, and so everything's, you know, you're embracing everything. So it uses the visuals to get inside the heads of these kids, I think. But you're right, I think it's not the easiest film in the world to warm to, and I think that's possibly, you know, intentional, or it's possibly something that will come with for this director in time.
Beautiful to
look at, and
quite smart, but like you say, it's cold. You come out of it not feeling sort of energized by it in any way. I mean, and that's what I found hard about it. But I mean, to watch the people in there acting, and to look at the way that it's filmed, it's very well done.
Yeah, and the music's lovely as well. Do you think you've got two words for us?
I had, I've got.
You've got lots.
You know, I got the promise of companionship.
Oh, good. Nice work, nice work. So for me, my two words to that I'm going to use to try and sum up the weight of elephants is not boy. Just in case anyone was thinking that it might be. All right, time for some news now.
On the eve of the North American premiere of his latest film, The Wind Rises, esteemed Japanese director Hayao Miyazaki has announced his retirement from filmmaking at the age of 72.
This is much, much wailing and rending of garments on the internet about this. The people are starting petitions.
Well, surely he's got more in him.
I had a little internal, like, meltdown.
72. I mean, Sister Loyola's what, 90?
Yeah, true.
Come on.
Yeah. But this is his second retirement. He tried to start filmmaking after the success of Princess Mononoke in 1997, but came back to win an Oscar for Spirited Away in 2003.
So maybe all is not lost. Maybe he just needs to be asked really, really nicely.
Or maybe he'll just sit down for a year and get bored and come back.
Yeah, well, that's true,
too. You never know. Eagle-eared listeners will be aware that we have paid close attention to the casting speculation for 50 Shades of Grey for some time now, and the news that Dakota Johnson, daughter...
It's almost the only film that we're looking forward to.
Oh, I'm not looking forward to this.
Oh, my goodness.
No,
who
you're right.
Am I going to... Actually, no, my roommate will totally come with me.
Those masks, the mask sales will go up when that comes out.
Yeah, We could do a giveaway with Device.
There you go. That's the sort of go-ahead forward thinking we're interested in. Yes, sorry, I interrupted you.
Dakota Johnson, daughter of Melanie Griffith and Don Johnson, will join Charlie Hunnam from Pacific Rim. He was the hero. In case you don't know his name, because many people probably don't. In the film, destined to do for sexual deviancy what Twilight did for vampires. And this book is basically from Twilight fans, so... It's all connected.
Yeah. I was watching a little bit of breakfast TV this morning, and there was a little ticker running along the bottom which said unknowns cast in 50 Shades of Grey. And I thought, that's a bit rude. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe for breakfast television watchers, but, you know, Pacific Rim, $400 million internationally. That's not chop liver.
I had one friend on Facebook get really excited about the announcement that Hunnam was in it. So... Okay. She's excited.
Well, that's a trend, isn't it?
In other casting news, Guy Ritchie's reboot of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Do you say The Man from U.N.C.L.E. or do you have to spell it
U.N.C.L.E.
out?
No, you do U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. Has stars...
This is where I feel really old now.
U-N-C-L-E, you know.
Man of Steel's Henry Cavill and Lone Ranger Armie Hammer will team up as Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin, as well as Mad Men's Jared Harris. It's the character of Lane on Mad Men. The film starts shooting in London on Monday.
And I think this is really interesting news because, you know, we've been talking about stars and whether stars can sell a film. And, you know, remember we were talking about The Lone Ranger and there were standees of Armie Hammer in the foyer of cinemas. And I'm sure everybody walking past will have gone, who? Mm. And so now what
I
we
totally
do...
I totally want that cut out.
So now we've got two stars of this film. Who, if you just saw them walking down the street, you would not recognize them. You would not, you know, they are not box office on their own, these two, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a interesting choice.
So it's like doubling down. It's like, okay, well, we've got one person who nobody really knows about or cares about.
Two.
Now we're going to, boom.
Yeah, it's like, You know, in some ways, though, if that, you know, because. Having the big powerful lead and the cost involved in that, maybe this is just the sign of things to come. You know,
and actually, Guy Ritchie, let's think about the last reboot that he did, which was Sherlock Holmes, and the effect that had on Robert Downey Jr.'s career. The king hit of Iron Man and Sherlock Holmes really did the job for him. So maybe the lightning will strike twice for these two, and they'll finally get some character sort of their own.
I reckon that's a harder.
It is a harder,
It's a harder sell than Sherlock.
Yeah, and as we know from Mortal Instruments, the presence of Jared Harris does not automatically, give us confidence.
Shouldn't he be making another Sherlock Holmes film?
Jared Harris?
No.
Oh,
Guy Ritchie. Shouldn't he be busy flat out working on another guy? You know, Sherlock.
I don't know, but Jared Harris should be in Sherlock. That's a better place for him.
Yeah.
Being British and evil.
All right. It's time for just a quick review from me, because I'm the only one that has seen it, for Red 2.
11 million people are going to lose their lives if you don't help me.
Is there any way you could tell us where the bomb is?
I invented it.
It's not good.
MI6 has just given me a contract to kill you.
Apparently you're number one on Interpol's most wanted.
What did you say?
It's important to enjoy life while you still can.
Hello, Frank.
Who is she?
Trouble.
How are things?
Yeah, Frank. How are things?
What are you doing kissing my girl?
What happens in the Kremlin stays in the Kremlin.
Right, John Malkovich, Bruce Willis, Helen Mirren, and Mary Louise Parker back together again for Red 2, a sequel to, I think, would you call this a surprise hit, Simon, the first Red one?
I would. I'd call it a sleeper hit. The one that, you know, the low expectations and then it surprised, I think.
I had forgotten until the credits rolled on this one that it was based on a comic book. So it counts as, you know, yet another of those comic book adaptations. It's a DC Comics title. And it's about a bunch of retired former secret agents, special ops people who are called back out into the field to save the world one more time. Helen Mirren is a international hit woman. Bruce Willis is ex-CIA. John Malkovich, Special Forces. Mary Louise Parker is the innocent Midwestern girl who falls for Bruce Willis, who is sort of dragged along with them.
But gets a taste for it.
Gets a taste for it, yeah. I think that would be fair enough. And also Anthony Hopkins in this one as a mad scientist. And I suppose it's jolly enough. It's certainly a lot more fun than Die Hard 5 was, if we were sort of rating it on a Bruce Willis scale. But my problem with this film, as with the one that we're going to talk about next, is that it doesn't feel like a film so much as just a series of moments, a series of set pieces. And while each set piece is really just a setup for a gag. There's no character development. There's no character depth. Everything's a variation on the same jokey theme about, Bruce Willis being sort of a bit of a cold fish, bit of a tight ass. Malkovich being sort of mad as a snake. And, you know, it's the same joke repeated scene after scene after scene. And I found it to be, you know, pretty tiresome by the end. And
it's not short, is it, either?
It's not short, and that's not to say that it wouldn't be entertaining. If I stumbled across this on a Saturday night and it was on television or something like that, I might, you know, stick with it, and it would probably be enough. But, you know, there's nothing special about this film, and it certainly feels like that everybody in it is, apart from one, everybody in it is really is just sort of it's by numbers. You know, there's no spark there. Willis, there was a time when he was like one of the most charming, sort of sexy presences on screen. And, you know, it's a long time since we've been able to say that, and this doesn't really help. I will say that Mary Louise Parker, why she isn't an international megastar, I don't know, because she's just fantastic. She was fantastic in the first one, fantastic in this one. You're making a face, aren't you, Simon?
Maybe it's because of the...
I think she's great. Yep. I think she's great, and she's the only one in this film that's really that seems to be having fun with it.
But she announced that she was leaving Hollywood earlier this year.
Yeah, well,
so
maybe she hasn't been. Maybe she just hasn't played the game the way that the other stars.
Out of the spotlight, she's tired of the bullies and the paparazzi and people getting her down. She's not tough enough.
Yeah, maybe that's it from a career point of view. She wasn't prepared to play the game, but certainly, if the one saving grace for the whole of Red 2 is Mary Louise Parker, who I've enjoyed her television work before now, but certainly haven't seen her nearly enough on the big screen. That's basically it. Neither of you guys have seen it, have you? Have I sold it to you?
Oh, I want to check it out.
Yeah,
because I enjoyed the first one. And so on. Oh, I've got, you know, there's a curiosity factor to it. So, yeah, I want to check it out. See it.
Okay.
I'm not a big Willis fan.
So. I'm a big Willis fan.
Mm. Yeah,
Willis.
But the thing is that my goodwill towards Bruce Willis is wearing pretty thin.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, his His get out of jail cards are just starting to run out, aren't they? Yeah.
Exactly. I'm trying to think of two words to.
But you'd love to see him in Die Hard, the original, wouldn't you? Again, if it was on TV always. One night, you'd always stop and watch it.
Always. Yeah. Once a year for
12 Monkeys. I'm there.
Yeah, that's right. I think basically anything before sort of 1991, and we're all good. We're all good with Bruce. But
what was that crazy one? The Resident Evil woman in it, Mila Jovovich.
The Fifth Element.
Yeah, another good one, eh?
The Fifth Element is legendary,
though. It's awesome, yeah. Isn't it? Mm.
Yeah.
Awesome, awesome.
So there we go.
Chris Rock was in that too, eh?
Well, yeah.
Mm. He played the person on the spaceship and, you know, like who was the sort of MC. Remember? You don't. Was it Chris Rock? Or
No, it was the other one. It was the other guy. He was the guy out of
the Jackie Chan action films. What's his name?
He was in Silver Linings Playbook.
And he was in Silver Linings Playbook. Yeah. Well, very. You've got the iPad there. Yeah. Look it up.
Nah,
and what's his name? And
don't
that
other
guy.
Yeah. So, crumbs.
Have I taken you somewhere else now, Dan?
Two words for Red 2, and all I can say really is, by the numbers.
Right.
That's nearly two Fair words, enough. Isn't it?
By numbers. Yeah.
Yep. Poor. So, but it's time to get onto something that we can really get excited about because we're all big fans of this gentleman's products. Let's talk about Ashton Kutcher as Steve Jobs.
Welcome to Apple Computer.
Is this everything?
Startup.
I think we should start with around 90 grand.
Could you repeat that?
If you'll have me aboard.
Trust me, I'm a INDEPENDENT.
Apple Incorporated went public this morning.
Chasing dreams since I was 14. Y'all can't stop me.
We gotta make the small things unforgettable.
Typeface isn't a pressing issue. Get out.
I got a really hard time for my two-word reviews after last week, and it's not getting any better, is it? Just so apologize to all of you for bringing us into two-word disrepute. Kaylee, you saw Jobs last night. Did you stick it out to the end, even though it was the late session?
Barely.
And were you holding your iPhone in the air?
I don't have an iPhone.
Oh, you don't?
I have an Android.
Well, no wonder.
But your Android would not exist if it wasn't for Steve.
That's true. Although I'm surprised that Bill Gates kept working after that threatening phone call that he got from Steve that scene. Jobs is a biopic about Steve Jobs, about the formation of Apple computers from a really great acid trip he had in college to forming Apple computers. Things jump around quite a bit.
Yeah, but
quickly.
Big things always happen from big acid trips, don't they?
Yeah. Yep. Especially if you do acid trips with like little rainbow stripes, like your logo.
Oh, okay. Nice.
And I'm trying to withhold my disappointment right now, but it's basically the Cliff Notes version of his life. It just sort of goes from big achievement to big achievement. There's a little bit of issues, but then it's just big achievement, big achievement.
And then
achievement
a third act disappointment and second act disappointment and a third act redemption. It's like, it is just classic three-act hero's journey stuff. You know, it doesn't bear much relationship to the truth of him or...
No. And you don't... And, I mean... I enjoyed Apple's products. I have an Apple computer because that was sort of standard at the university I went to. And, you know, I have my very old iPhone, which I now use an oversized iPod. But this film just isn't good. Honestly, it's just not good. It's too soon. And it's just chunky and you don't feel like you're getting the whole story. And it's really only about Steve Jobs. And there was a lot of other people that helped him get him to where he was. Who were obviously not credited. I have a little interview, some snippets from Steve Wozniak, the other main founder of Apple. It was in a television interview recently, and he said that there were a lot of things wrong with the film, according to him, and the movie inaccurately glorified Jobs without acknowledging his flaws as a young entrepreneur and without giving due credit to other people involved in the company's early days. I didn't like seeing a lot of people I know not get the respect they deserve, he added. When asked if he had a message for Kutcher, Wozniak replied, "You know what? I'm really easy to get a hold of. He could have just called me and consulted over the phone anytime." Wozniak was in fact invited to consult on the film, but declined after reading the script, saying he and his wife were abhorred by it. But he is consulting on Aaron Sorkin's forthcoming Steve Jobs film.
Which is going to be more interesting because it's not a biopic. The Sorkin version is going to be three single scenes in the life and career of like crucial moments in the career of Steve Jobs, which brings me back to the problem that I have with Jobs. This particular film is that, first of all, it's just so linear and so by the book. And in fact, by the book by Walter Jacobson, which lots of people will have read, the biography of Jobs, it just plucks moments, sort of dramatic moments out of that book and then tries to sort of bring them to life. I think it does a really amazing job of recreating the world. I think the art department deserves a pat on the back because it all looks, you know, amazing. And I think they've gone to such a lot of trouble to try and recreate the world. They even used Jobs' old house as the location for, or his parents' house for where Apple Computer was formed. So, you know, they went to an enormous amount of trouble to get those sort of details right, but it has no life, and it also doesn't illuminate what Jobs or Apple meant. You know, there's all this talk about how, you know, the crazy ones and how the Apple products have unleashed the creativity of millions of people, and, you know, we're now doing things in the world that we never would have done before. And you know, I can put my hand on my heart and say that I wouldn't be doing this with you guys now, recording this podcast, if it wasn't for Apple products and learning how to use Apple products, taking my career in particular directions. So, you know, it has, on that basis, Steve Jobs did change my life. But that impact and that resonance is completely missing from the film. Like, it doesn't get why it was important. It just gets that he was a mercurial character and tries to fit that character into a standard sort of biopic narrative, which is, yeah, really disappointing.
Yeah, and he's a very, in the film you can see he's a very driven person and he will crush anyone in his way, but that made him a really unlikable character. And so you sort of come out of it and it's like, oh well, he's a bit of a jerk.
I don't think that was terribly inaccurate. And is a problem with just taking him as the center of the story, is that that's always likely to be a factor. For me, the biggest criticism, or the way I would sum the film up, is that Jobs himself was famous for his taste, and I'd have to say that he would have hated this film. You know, like, that regardless of its how accurately it portrays him, it doesn't seem to contain a sort of the essence or its own, or a coherent sort of internal truth to it. And I just think that he would have hated every minute of it, and on that basis it's not worthy of him, it's not worthy of the world that he helped bring into reality.
So you're not selling this one to me.
Well, I have to say that this is definitely one of the, I can't say it's a disappointment, because I think you're right, Kaylee, that it is too soon. I don't think there's really any great perspective. It's been rushed into production
And that opening scene, it's like we're about to watch Lincoln or something. And I was just sitting there like, are you kidding me? Like, yes, Steve Jobs was great. Yes, he was a visionary. But it's like, you know, it was like the film Diana is coming out this year. That is a decent length of time to sort of deal with these things.
But that will only work if it takes her story and uses it to tell some kind of universal story, or some kind of story that actually relates back to society or to culture or to us in some way, you know, that isn't just scene after scene of things that happen to her in her life, because that, you know, that doesn't teach us anything about ourselves. And we go to the movies to learn about ourselves as much as we go to learn about other people, you know, that, and so, yeah, it's, And that's the problem with this particular film, is that actually there's no great resonance, there's no great teachings, there's nothing that you could learn that you would use in your own life. And yeah, it was just like scene after scene after scene, and also really clunky, as you said. You know, nobody gets introduced without anybody using their surname, just so you know exactly who they were. And quite often their names are repeated just so that you remember. And it's there's another film that I think is out of embargo, so I might be able to mention this now, although it's not coming out here for a few weeks, which is Rush. Which is a similar sort of thing, in that it's a real biopic of real people, and real scenarios are recreated for you, and it has to help an audience through who these characters are. And you know, and the first half of Rush does almost exactly the same thing, is that everybody gets introduced a couple of times. Everybody sits around and explains what's going on to people who know bloody well already what's going on, thank you. But then in the second half it really takes off, but we can talk about Rush when it comes out.
Yeah, I just want to go on a tangent about Rush.
Yes.
That they have just launched their marketing campaign, which is like talking about the great battles of in history, like one sports person against another, and they have this little timeline, and Senna and Proust aren't on it.
No.
Whoa. I was like,
that's like a slap in the face.
It was a slap in the face.
That's a slap in the face. Well, let's see if we can. I'm going to put you on the spot. Were you sitting there thinking about two words?
Yes, because the people around me were talking through the whole film, and iPhones were going off. And my two words for the film, which I've already said, are too soon.
Ah, right, too soon. That's good. My two words, it's actually only one word for Jobs, and that is eye beard.
Beard. not big Jobs.
No. You should have gone so you could have used that.
I know, I like it.
Yeah. Number two. Ashton Kutcher spent so much time getting his gait down properly.
Walk, right. Yeah, there's almost so no acting. Weird. It's all impersonation, no acting, isn't it?
It's interesting because he's not challenged enough. Ashton, I think he could deliver.
He could
a lot
be better.
More.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly got. I think movie star potential.
Yes.
Like the camera likes him. Big screens like him. But he just doesn't choose the right projects. He should have a word with us. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Do we want to just remind people how to get the last of our movie tickets?
Yes.
Just hashtag away, basically.
Yeah, hashtag. We still have some tickets for The Patient Stone and for Blue Jasmine, so if you'd like those tickets, please send us a tweet that says, I would like some hashtag Blue Jasmine tickets, please. And it has to be like that. We're not just giving away freebies.
No, that's right. You have to earn it.
Yeah.
Use the word please.
And please.
Oh, please would be good. Yeah, that's right. Definitely. That would make a change. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, we've been talking about Blue Jasmine on the show. We'll actually review it. Woody Allen is back, and apparently back for good. And it's also Channing Tatum's turn to save the president in White House Down. So we'll be talking about that and more in next week's no doubt exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. We'll also play some extracts from Sunday afternoon's live Q&A with the creative forces behind Gardening with Soul. That we would tell you about that event, but it's already sold out. So we're going to be doing is just disappointing you, unfortunately. But you will be able to hear all of it as a special Cinematica extra episode, and we'll play extracts from it in the show next week. So if you're interested in Gardening with Soul, one of the great New Zealand documentaries, then tune in next week. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favorite podcasting software so the latest episode arrives as if by magic. Remember, leave feedback at the iTunes store. Those ratings, those reviews help push us up the rankings. And you can contact us and give us your two-word reviews and suggestions for topics through almost every electronic and non-electronic medium.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter via @CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd, where you can read our two-word reviews. You'll find us as Cinematica, and of course on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. We're leaving you with some more music. This is actually from Jobs. This is John Debney's score, the closing theme, in fact. It's called Think Different. And until next week, that's all from me.
And all from me.
And me. Good night.
I'm frowning about the Jobs music.